Good morning. And welcome to week four. If you weren't depressed yet after what was it? We did stress, we did addiction, we did OCD. I've been doing my best to try to ruin your week. We're going to try again today with depression. If you survive this, then next week is rest and relaxation, and the following week is logotherapy, which, believe it or not, will be a gust of fresh air. As always, I'm recording the audio, and I will send out the link I expect later today. If anyone has a cell phone and the ringer is on, if you could please silence it or vibrate it or whatever you want to do to it without a hammer. Depression, as I said, frankly, when we dealt with OCD as well and when we dealt with addiction as well, it's a sensitive topic. I'm going to try to do it justice. There's a lot to be said, and also, as I said, regarding those other topics, it's certainly true regarding depression. I don't think there is such a thing as a family in North America, certainly, that doesn't have experience with this. And I'm going to try to keep the discussion, as well as the comments that people make, more on the topic of depression in general and less on specific cases that people are dealing with. And I am not a doctor. I don't pretend to be. Practical questions should really go to the experts. I have two questions that I want to address here. I think I put it in the email that I sent out in advance as well. Number one, how was depression viewed historically in Jewish tradition and in Jewish law? And then two, what lessons of Judaism can be useful in dealing with, in therapy for, clinical depression? So you have to start by defining what we're talking about. What is depression? And there are really two basic classes of clinical depression. I suspect that you're familiar with it, but I brought a source for it anyway. Yes, Ian, it's an American source. I apologize. I got lazy. That's really the truth of it. The Americans are better at search engine optimization, and they show up higher in the results. But take a look at from the American Psychological Association. Everyone experiences sadness at times, but depression is something more. Depression is extreme sadness or despair that lasts more than days. It interferes with the activities of daily life and can even cause physical pain. Fortunately, depression is highly treatable. So, first of all, it's more than just sadness. Number one, in terms of its scope, it's something that is extreme. And number two, in terms of its duration, it lasts more than a period of days. It interferes with daily life. It can lead to physical pain as well. We talked about that a little bit when we talked about stress, the fact that that what's going on psychologically will impact the body as well. And it is treatable. And they continue to give you a statistic here. Depression, also known as major depressive disorder or clinical depression, is one of the most common mental disorders in the United States. In 2014, an estimated 15.7 million adults in the U.S., about 6.7% of all U.S. adults, had at least one major depressive episode. Insert Trump joke here for where the statistics have gone since then, according to the National Institute of Mental Health. But actually, what I wanted to emphasize, and I thought I had brought it in this source, I see that I didn't quote the full piece, is that there are these two classes of depression. There is the biochemical, and then there is the psychological. That doesn't mean that they're entirely separate, but it's important to understand the separate origins of each. Biochemical, we're not going to go through all the biochemistry. It can be related to the neurotransmitters in the brain. It can be related to hormonal balance. But fundamentally, this is something which causes a feeling of despair, causes a feeling of helplessness, causes inactivity, causes listlessness, and it has nothing to do with what the person's thought process is. It doesn't have to do with coping mechanisms. It's simply biology. And that's one type. The other type is psychological. It's a reaction to sad events transcending normal grief. And it leads to debilitating feelings of despair, low energy, and so on. And a person becomes overwhelmed by trying to deal with life while they're still coping with this extreme grief. And because there are two different origins, they also need different kinds of treatment. And here I brought you a quote from Rabbi Dr. Abraham Tversky. I mentioned him when we talked about addiction. And he has a great deal to say about depression, as he does about psychological conditions in general. But this is just from a brief piece from a video that he filmed explaining a view on depression and treatment for depression. And this is just, I wrote this out as a transcript of his remarks. He says, "So I think we have to be able to distinguish between the two, meaning between the biochemical and the psychological." He says, "I can be depressed, but not have a depression." What does he mean by that?
Not severe.
It may not be severe, right? A person can be depressed. Not every experience of grief, sadness, is automatically a clinical depression. A person can be depressed. And then he continues to say, strangely enough, one can have a clinical depression and not be depressed. And it will show itself in an inability to feel. In other words, what he's talking about here is a very important point in understanding the biochemistry involved. Biochemical depression may not be manifest with the symptoms that we think of as depression. The person is just sad. The person is upset. Not necessarily. Biochemical depression may be manifest in a person simply having their emotions flattened. And they just can't be moved to respond to whatever is happening, and they can't be moved to act. As he says, it will show itself in an inability to feel. The two, even though there's so much overlap, and even though there's overlap in their responses to situations, it's important to recognize they're two separate animals. And so he says, trying to do psychotherapy with a person who's got a biochemical depression is like trying to tune the television set when it's not plugged in. Right? It's not effective. It's a very important thing because in general in society we have stigma about going for psychological treatment, but we have a double stigma when it comes to medication. Right? And people are afraid to go that route, but they have to realize talking it out even with the best, most expert counselor isn't going to solve a biochemical problem. Yeah, Ian, you were going to say?
No? I'll catch you later.
You catch me later, okay. But I think it's something that's so important to recognize regarding this, that the treatment for biochemical depression has to be biochemical. And then separate from that, we have psychotherapy. Susan?
When you use the term psychotherapy, we've been using it all these weeks. Could you just explain
Perfect segue. Perfect segue. Let's take a look at sources 3 and 4 because that will address it directly. First, from the Mayo Clinic. This is just a broad statement, and then we'll get specific in number 4. Medications and psychotherapy are effective for most people with depression. Your primary care doctor or psychiatrist can prescribe medications to relieve symptoms. However, many people with depression, by which they mean clinical depression, also benefit from seeing a psychiatrist, psychologist, or other mental health professional. In other words, it's not just about the medication. Very often, the medication will relieve symptoms. The medication may help make things better. But the therapy piece of it, talking things through, developing the coping mechanisms, is also important. So how does that psychotherapy work? That's number 4. Psychotherapy is a talk therapy in which people work with trained professional therapists to discuss their problems and learn new skills. Psychotherapy can help depressed individuals to talk about their experiences and feel listened to, gain insight into, and often some measure of control over the thinking processes that lead to depressed moods, explore the contribution of past experiences to present-day distress, and learn practical coping skills that can help decrease the likelihood of developing future depressive episodes. So psychotherapy is presented here, both in terms of what it is and in terms of what its goals are and what it's trying to accomplish, as working with somebody who is trained to have the conversation in which the patient coming in is going to discuss the problem, is going to talk about what it is that is not working, and through this conversation with the psychologist, psychotherapists, psychologists, psychiatrists if you're dealing with someone who deals in medication. But fundamentally, it gives the opportunity for things like validation, to recognize the legitimate roots of what this person is dealing with. It gives the opportunity to have a safe space just to even have the conversation. You know, one of the hallmarks of depression is that people who have it will close themselves off from people around them. They don't feel like engaging others. It requires too much energy. It requires vulnerability. But the result of that is that they're living in an echo chamber, right? They have nobody to talk to but themselves, and their own response to everything is, this world is terrible. Psychotherapy gives them the opportunity to have the conversation with somebody who gets it, who knows what's going on, who respects what they're dealing with, and who can help them try to cope with it, to find ways to address the problems that they're, you know, that they have and that they're trying to confront. Stephen and then Marlene.
The support groups would be able to fall in this category, not just individual to individual therapists, widow support groups, healing groups, there's all kinds of groups that have.
So it's an interesting question, support groups. Meaning, certainly support groups for all sorts of experiences are important. I'm not sure when you get down to counseling that they work as well. I think they're a good supplement. But I think that, but I think in terms of the counseling, it may really need the one-on-one. That would be my sense of it. Not being a professional, I would bow to the professionals on this, but that would be my sense of it. Marlene.
Most depressed people experience trigger points, certain things set them off. If they have a personal psychotherapist who they've seen or talked to for years, they identify that very quickly.
Right. It's a very good point. The person who's suffering from depression is not really able to self-diagnose and to recognize what they're vulnerable to and what triggers things. And having somebody to work with, just because they're objective, just because they're not the person experiencing it, can help give them the tools to be able to address things. Thank you. So that's just basic definition of what depression is, and a little bit about treatment. There are worlds more to say, and I suspect that a lot of people here know more than I do about that, so I'm certainly not going to preach on that. The Jewish part, I think, is where I might have something to contribute. Gary.
Okay. I think these statistics are way, way off.
Yeah.
I just sold business 150
people, and
I tell you, and out of those 150, 25% of those people would come to me and tell me they were depressed. So I think these statistics have to do with those people who are seeing psychiatrists or whatever.
Right. So Gary makes a
good point. Yeah. That do not report their depression.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
They're driving around, they won't report it, they're embarrassed to go to a counselor or what have you.
Right. So Gary points out the problem that you have when you're dealing with statistics. There are some people who will tell you, as Gary is saying here from his personal experience, the people who he has seen and interacted with, that these numbers are simply too low. That there are many more people who will not report it, even if you call them up on the telephone and say, we're taking a poll, right? Either they'll hang up the phone, or they're not going to be honest about it, because really, who wants to tell an anonymous person over the phone, yes, I'm dealing with depression. Or I wasn't before you called, but now. On the other hand, I have to give you the flip side. Right? The flip side is that there are those who argue that these numbers are high because there's a tendency to overdiagnose. There's a book called Saving Normal. Have anyone heard of this book? Okay, it was put out by the psychiatrist, I believe, who was in charge of the DSM-4. The DSM-4 is the standard diagnostic manual used in the field of psychology, in the field of psychiatry. It came out of an attempt decades ago to try to make psychology more scientific. The goal was to get it out of the realm of something extremely subjective and say, here are our categories, and here is our clinical diagnosis, and here is what we prescribe for it. And And it has moved steadily in the direction of adding categories and adding diseases and adding treatments and taking things which at one point were just considered, okay, the person is sad or the person is upset or the person had a bad experience, and giving them a name and giving them a label. And the author of, the head of the DSM-IV, that was the fourth edition, criticizes in this book, Saving Normal, the fifth edition, and says that they've gone too far. That they have now labeled children's temper tantrums as a psychological ailment. And they've given it a name and everything else. And there is a movement of people who believe that actually depression was always at the levels it is today, and it's just that we didn't have a name for it. And we didn't call it illness. We just said, yeah, they're upset, deal with it. And now that's changed. I can't take sides on the issue because some days I'm convinced by Gary's point that there are many more people, and some days I'm convinced by the Saving Normal argument that there are fewer people. What I can say, though, and this is something that I think is common sense, is that the biochemical aspect of it was underreported for a very long time. The aspect of it that is a function of neurotransmitters, something going on in the brain, that aspect of it was undercounted, and the result of it is that people who needed treatment were told, you can manage it, just get over it, you know, snap out of it, and so on, and it really wasn't within their ability to do so. So Saving Normal may be right that we're now over-categorizing things, and creating things that shouldn't be created in terms of a diagnosis. Nonetheless, there's a very real need for treatment for an awful lot of people, whether the numbers here are right or whether the numbers here are only 50% of what it really is. And I think that's an important thing to recognize. Elaine, and then Paul, and then Sharon. Well, one by one. Yeah.
I don't know if there's any reference in Judaism to even the idea or concept of this, but there's a lot of current research being done on the connection between physical disease and mental health, usually manifested as depression.
Mm-hmm.
I think about 2 or 3 months ago in the New York Times, there was a big article about some research that was going on in the U.S., and I have a sister-in-law who lives in Florida whose life was saved because her doctor was convinced this was an upbeat, extroverted, out there, enjoying everything all the time with a smile on her face person who suddenly, and a psychologist by profession, suddenly became so depressed that she couldn't get out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
Watching.
Right.
And her doctor had been reading up on this connection between possible physical disease and manifesting itself, whether it also changes the neurotransmitters or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know that they've gotten that far.
Right.
But she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Only because the doctor was so convinced she pulled out every examining piece of equipment.
Right.
She could think of to find what was going on.
Right. Absolutely. The first time I visited somebody after open heart surgery, I remember that I was told before, and you should know, people who go through open heart surgery have higher incidences of depression afterwards. And whether that is, as one cardiologist said to me, just because they're forced to confront their mortality, or whether it's because of some kind of an imbalance in the system that is associated with it, I can't say. But it's definitely true that we are seeing that there are physical diseases that will be associated with signs of depression. I said after that, Paul, right?
Okay. People
get
confused between feeling low and clinical depression.
Yes.
Clinical depression, from what I know, is something that lasts about two weeks, not just a few.
Right, that's what we had said in the in one of the sources here. More than just a few days. That's correct. Agreed. Right. No, agreed. And I think the professionals have a hard time too. Right. It's hard, without a doubt. Sharon?
Was there any research done on what caused the initial depression in people who have a chemical event, like a flow, a loss?
Or... Right, so this is a good question. Sharon asks a question that I'm not really qualified to answer, which is, what triggers depression? And the answer may well be that biology may put a person in a state in which they'll have a harder time responding to certain triggers, and then the trigger comes along and throws them off. That can be it, but honestly, you'd have to ask a psychologist to get a better answer.
But yeah. Can I also think after an operation, you say people get depressed, and sometimes that could be because a lot of them lost a part of their body or something.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. Yeah. We'll take one last, and then we'll go forward. No?
Let's go forward.
Okay. Let's go forward. So, in Jewish tradition, there are accounts of depression that go all the way back to Tanakh. The accounts of what looks an awful lot like clinical depression. Now, here you get into very dangerous territory because you're trying to diagnose people who you've never met, and you may know about one or two or three stories from their life, but nonetheless, we're going to try to say, well, that person was dealing with depression. In general, I don't believe in doing so. You know, I've heard the argument that in the Book of Esther, when King Ahasuerus can't sleep, that he's dealing with depression, and it's hard for him to sleep. Frankly, when you read the book, and I think we had a class on this a couple of years ago, he seems to have suffered some kind of an anxiety disorder. He was always looking over his shoulder and worried about who might be after him, but you know what they say, it's not paranoia if they really are out to get you. And given that he faces at least one plot against the throne in the book, he can be forgiven this. But a more serious association is made in the story of Shaul HaMelech, the story of King Saul, where Tanakh describes somebody who was coronated as king, was ruling, seems to have been fully functional as a ruler. God then rejects him and says he has not followed my commands. He tells the prophet Shmuel, Samuel, to name David as the new king while Saul is still sitting on the throne. In general, in the Middle East, that's a really bad idea. Right? Naming the new leader while the old leader is still alive. Not a good idea in general, but the Middle East for sure. And you find a description for him in the... I brought you English. I didn't bring you the Hebrew. But it's really striking in terms of what happens to him, the change that overcomes him, where he actually attempts to kill David, who had been one of his favorites beforehand. And not just on one occasion, but on multiple occasions, he attempts to kill him, and then he apologizes afterwards, and he says, I would never do that. And then he goes back and he does it again. And take a look at source number 5 and number 6, please. This is a verse, one of the verses from Shmuel, from Samuel, that described this. It says, and the Spirit of God left Saul, and a harmful spirit from God frightened him. On that, Don Isaac of Barbanel, writing at the end of the 15th century, said, source number 6, he, Saul, was surrounded by confusion and bad thoughts, and his imagination was continually occupied with his punishment, how God had torn the throne of Israel from him, and how his good spirit had left him. By the way, the description there as well talks about how he had David brought to him to play music, because music would calm him. From this, his blood burned and he developed the, quote, melancholy disease, which happens from the burning of blood and red bile. The doctors have already written that in this disease, imagination and the power of thought are destroyed, pain and worry befall him, and he will fear and tremble and churn in depression. I would not personally feel comfortable diagnosing somebody from Tanakh on the basis of even many stories. However, Don Isaac of Barbanel, who knew Tanakh far better than I do, felt very comfortable using biological terms to describe the state of Saul, what his frame of mind was. Now, he's working with the biology of his day, right? And the concept of the four humors and the different bile within the body and the balances of fluids and so forth, that's par for the course. But he views this as something which was fundamentally biological in nature and made Saul unable to cope with the loss of the throne. Fast forward in Jewish history to the period of the Talmud and the classic story of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish are leading sages of, call it roughly, the 4th century into the 5th century. and they are perennial sparring partners. Rabbi Yochanan says something, Reish Lakish disagrees. You can find it every few pages in the Talmud. Interestingly, and not paradoxically, they were also related by marriage. Reish Lakish was married to Rabbi Yochanan's sister. So it's not a coincidence that when one said one thing, the other one disagreed. No, actually Rabbi Yochanan was the one who introduced him to his sister. And there's a long backstory involving them. But take a look at source number 7, which is a very painful story. When Reish Lakish died, Rabbi Yochanan missed him painfully. The sages said, "Who will go settle his mind? Let Rabbi Elazar ben Pedat go, for his learning is sharp." So he went before Rabbi Yochanan. Whenever Rabbi Yochanan said something, he said, "Here's a source supporting you." Rabbi Yochanan said, "Will you be like Reish Lakish? When I said something, Reish Lakish would challenge it in 24 ways, and I would answer it in 24 ways. And so our learning grew. You say, here's a source supporting you. Don't I know what I said is good? I need you to tell me there's something that supports me." Rabbi Yochanan went about tearing his clothing and weeping, saying, "Where are you, Reish Lakish? Where are you, Reish Lakish?" and wailing until his mind left him. The sages prayed for mercy upon him, and he died. This is a description which, again, diagnosing someone you've never met, very dicey, but you're describing here extreme grief. That's really what this sounds like, and he's unable to get out of it. You find many more. I could have brought you any number of sources on specific medical terms that are used in the Talmud, which are diagnosed and explained as related to depression. The Talmud has a term, yokra deliba. Yokra deliba is Aramaic for a heavy heart. Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, a pediatric neurologist in Israel today, believes that that's actually a term for depression. Many authorities in Jewish law spoke historically about what was called marash hara, black bile, as something that would contribute to a condition of depression. I brought you one source just because it's so powerful. Right, Moses Maimonides in source number 8. Of course, you know, Rambam was also a physician. And he talks about a state of melancholy. You know, there's a classic passage from the Mishnah, which is recited traditionally Friday night. In shul by Ashkenazim. Sephardim don't say it. They say something called Kigavna. Ashkenazim say Bamem Avligin. It's the second chapter of Mishnah in the section of Mishnah called Shabbat. It's recited there largely because it deals with candle lighting, what fuels you use for candle lighting, and what way you light the candles, as well as how to accept Shabbos. That's the section of Mishnah. But at one point it talks about under what circumstances one would be allowed to extinguish a flame on Shabbos, on Shabbat. And one of the justifications it gives is because of Ruach Ra'ah. Ruach Ra'ah, literally a bad spirit. And Maimonides commenting there does not explain bad spirit to mean a demon. That's not what bad spirit means. But rather, he says, it refers to somebody who's suffering from melancholy and needs to be in the dark in order to calm down. And the light is disturbing them. And that's one of the justifications that's actually brought. Obviously, it depends on the severity of the circumstance and so on. But the idea seen there is, number one, the recognition of this state of melancholy, as they called it. And number two, the willingness to recognize it and give it value in Jewish law, in halacha. Take a look at number 8, which is another description by Maimonides of this black bile melancholy. He says, "One who has black bile rise up in him should remove it with songs and types of music, strolling in gardens and beautiful buildings, and sitting with pretty sculptures. This will broaden his spirit and remove the worry of black bile." What's he trying to give you? Coping mechanisms. He's trying to give you coping mechanisms. Yeah.
They aren't far off because now they talk about imbalance. Mm-hmm. So he actually, they were talking about imbalance, whether it's bile or that, we hear that term all the time.
Right. Oh no, there's a lot to be said for the biology that they had. They're working with the information at their disposal. There was not a clear understanding at that point in human history of things like the circulatory system. But what they were observing, they were very astute in. They were very good at understanding what they saw and coping with the fact that the biology that they had just didn't match up with the acuity of their observation. You find it discussed a lot as you go further in Jewish history. When you get to the realm of Hasidut, right? The Hasidim are always pictured as being smiling and happy. That's sort of the stereotypical image. But the truth of the matter is, there's a reason for that. They do emphasize the way one feels. The schools of Musar. Musar means what?
Bad.
It doesn't mean bad. So literally, Musar is ethics. Literally, it's ethics, but the term can also mean, if you play with the grammar a little bit, rebuke. And so the term Musar is often used for strong ethical instruction. One of the basic tenets of the Musar movement is that a person has to make sure to always have hope and to stay away from what's called in Gemara terminology, Yeush. What is Yeush?
Giving up,
loss of hope. The term Yeush shows up in the Talmud most commonly regarding property. I'm walking in Union Station, and I drop my, whatever, library card or whatever it is, and I realize later that I lost it in Union Station. So, the Talmud says, at that point you tend to feel yeush. You're like, ah, forget it, I'm never going to see this thing again. But it means abandonment of hope. It means feeling like this is never going to be remedied. And there's one of the classic works of Musar is called Orchot Tzadikim, The Paths of the Righteous. And I bring you a quote which I saw after I made up the source sheet, or I would have included it on there. He says, "Hadaga v'hayagon heim mechalim halev. Worry and sorrow destroy the heart." It's a recognition of the impact that depression can have. Yeah.
So, if they recognize so early depression and why is it that suicide were not allowed to be buried? I mean, if they recognize it as an illness.
Right. Good question. So Betty asks the question of if they were familiar with this and they recognized the biological basis and they knew how devastating this is, why is it that people who committed suicide would not be buried in the cemetery? So a couple of points. First, historically, within Jewish practice, the idea of excluding somebody from the cemetery was honored more in the breach. Meaning, the people were, generally speaking, buried with full honors and so on, and with the understanding that they were not in their right mind at the time when they did this, or they regretted it, but it was too late once they regretted it, and therefore they were always in. I like to tell the story of when I was a rabbi in Pennsylvania. I once visited the community in Scranton for a funeral, and went to the cemetery, and the cantor there showed me a certain grave, and he said, you know, that person used to be outside the cemetery. That person was the only case of which I am aware in which somebody was actually buried outside the cemetery, and it was because they had taken their own life. And they ended up being in the cemetery because cemeteries expand. So they ended up being back in, you know, after all. But I can tell you, as somebody who officiated at and was familiar with quite a few cases in which people took their own lives, it's very rare that somebody would end up outside. The reason for doing it at all isn't really about them. The reason for putting them outside at all is to avoid, unfortunately, the copycat phenomenon, in which people see somebody else took their life, they see how they are mourned, and they say to themselves, that's the best I can hope for myself, and they decide to go the same route. That was more the motivation behind that kind of treatment, but again, it was not a common thing to do. Susan.
When you talked about what was Mutar because of depression, was that the same idea as what you said with stress? Remember you
yes.
said about the guy who was
yes.
dying?
Yes. I mean, the idea of dispensations for people because of mental health issues is across the board.
Can you make a decision yourself, or do you have to ask a rabbi, or like how do these...
Right. So that's a really good question. And the answer is, the person on the spot needs to be the one to make the decision, whatever their expertise is. We have a general rule, which is very important to know. The Shulchan Aruch codifies it. The Code of Jewish Law codifies this, and it says, in the event that you are in a pikuach nefesh, life-saving situation, or even safek pikuach nefesh, you're not sure, the rule is that you don't ask questions, you simply do. And it says that somebody who stops to ask is considered a shedder of blood. That's how strong it is. Now, that means that people have to be trained beforehand, before the situation ever comes up, because otherwise, what do I know? How do I know what is recognized is not recognized, and that makes things dicey. It makes things difficult. As somebody who's been in the situation of having to decide, do we or don't we go to the hospital? I recognize that it's not easy, but you err on the side of caution. That's the overarching principle, is you err on the side of saving lives, and if afterwards it turns out you were mistaken, you did nothing wrong. That's the principle. What do you mean?
Let's say a country enemy.
That's a whole other discussion. I'm not going there. We had a series on war a couple of years ago. We could go back to. I want to show one other aspect of Jewish tradition in this regard. And that is when it comes to halacha, to Jewish law, because this has been taken very seriously. And here, actually, I bring you a Shabbos discussion. Take a look at source number 9, please. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, who is the retired now head of Internal Medicine Unit B at Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Israel, wrote one of the definitive works on medicine and Jewish law called Nishmas Avram. And he writes, regarding violating Shabbat, there is no distinction between one who suffers from physical ailments and one who suffers from psychological ailments. All of the rules taught regarding classification of physical illness based on the seriousness of the condition, the possibility of danger to life, apply to psychological illness as well. So, in other words, when it comes to physical illness, we have categories. We have what's called in Hebrew, chole sheyesh bo sakana, somebody who is dangerously ill. We have the category of chole she'ein bo sakana, somebody who is very ill, their life is not in danger, but they're bedridden, they can't function. And then you have the category of mechush ba'alma, somebody who's just, they're not feeling great. We have categories when it comes to physical ailments, and he says the same thing is true when you're dealing with psychological illness, and all the rules that pertain to each category will apply to psychological illness as well. He says, therefore, the law regarding violating Shabbat for this person, biblical or rabbinic law, depends on the severity of the condition. But absolutely, and there is a very long body of literature on it, we will violate Shabbat for somebody who needs to get psychological treatment. This comes up. This is a live question. The question of, if you have somebody who has an alcohol addiction and feels an urge to drink on Shabbos, are they allowed to call their buddy or their counselor or whatever it is on Shabbos? Can you drive somebody to an institution if need be on Shabbos? Can you commit someone to an institution if the institution will not have them observe Shabbos? These are all live, real questions that are asked today, and we, again, err on the side of saving lives. It's not just Shabbos. Shabbos happens to be a high-profile example, but actually I mentioned the institution case. Take a look at source number 10, where Moshe Feinstein wrote this in 1965. It was actually a response to a question from Toronto, from Rabbi Yaakov Emanuel Shochet, who had asked him the question. The question was about committing a young man to an asylum. That was the question, and there he would not be able to get kosher food. So his answer was, if doctors were to identify a life-saving issue, such as that he might respond to pain with suicide, or that he might violate civil law, not listen to the police and resist such that they might kill him, which is more remote, but he's willing to consider that as a factor, or that the illness itself is dangerous, such that his brain is damaged, he can only be healed there, then Rabbi Feinstein is willing to accept having him go into a place where they're not going to serve him kosher food. That's his position there. Source number 11 deals with the issue of postpartum depression and contraception. 1961. regarding a woman who became insane after the birth of her two children, such that doctors forbid further pregnancy. May she use contraception? You are probably familiar with the fact that Judaism in general is not a fan of contraceptive methods, although there are cases where different forms of contraception may be justified. I'm not saying it as a blanket principle, because it's not a blanket principle. There are types of contraception, and there are circumstances where it is warranted. And here, Rabbi Feinstein writes, certainly his honor is the person writing the letter to Rabbi Feinstein, his honor is correct. Insanity is dangerous not only for herself, but also for her small children. Even one whose insanity does not currently incline toward harm could still change, wanting to harm herself or her children, God forbid, and one cannot stand guard for this. Therefore, one should permit her, and he goes on with permitted means of contraception for her to make sure that she won't have another pregnancy. So this is recognized and has been recognized for a long time, obviously with greater sophistication in our age where psychology has advanced and psychiatry has advanced, but it's been recognized for a very long time within Judaism. I want to shift gears now, though, to the second piece, which is, what is it in Judaism that can help people in this circumstance? And I have a lot to say, so I'm actually not going to take questions at this point, because there's a lot to be said, and I want to make sure to get to it. There are four elements that I want to highlight. The most important one to me is to recognize, as Judaism does, that people dealing with depression are not crazy. The word crazy is simply the wrong word and the wrong term and the wrong concept. There is a myth propagated in certain circles, not Jewish circles, that if God is perfect, God's creation must be perfect. And therefore the world must be wonderful. It must be. And if it's not wonderful, then, you know, that means God doesn't exist. But it's not a Jewish concept. Judaism acknowledges and frankly teaches the broken character of the world around us. Broken in two ways. Number one, religiously, in the sense that there is evil in this world, and in terms of people's experience, in terms of the suffering that is present. I brought you a series of sources here to highlight this. Source number 12, Garden of Eden. Should sound familiar. The woman perceived that the tree was good for eating, that it was desirable to the eyes. The tree was good for gazing, and she took of its fruit, and she ate. Then she gave to her husband with her as well, and he ate. What day in the history of the world did this happen? What day? Day one. Day one of humanity. Not day one of the world. Day six of the world. Day one of humanity. God made us on Friday, late morning, and by early afternoon we had eaten the fruit. Right? It didn't take long. Message. Good things often are immediately followed by bad, and even the greatest heights don't necessarily lead to even greater heights or even sustained heights. Take a look at source number 13, a verse from Tehillim, from Psalms. Our ancestors in Egypt did not gain insight from your wonders, speaking to God, did not remember your great kindnesses, and they rebelled upon the Sea of Yam Suf. Psalms portrays the Jews as sinning when we crossed the sea. And there are different explanations for what that sin was. But you know that while we're standing there waiting at the sea, we turn to God and say, you know, weren't there enough graves in Egypt? You had to take us out. Right after we saw those great miracles, the 10 plagues, right? Immediately afterwards, we did this. We received the Torah, and 40 days later, source number 14, we made a golden calf. We entered Israel. We conquered the city of Jericho. And right after that, we had decreed that the spoils were off limits. This was not a war to take spoils. A fellow by the name of Achan, as I brought for you in source number 15, took from the spoils. King Solomon built the Beit HaMikdash. He built the temple. And as the Midrash records in source number 16, he married the daughter of the Pharaoh, who brought him types of music to play at the dedication of the temple, for him to hear how they play music for all of the various idols. And she put him to sleep with a curtain over his head with stars in that, with gems in it that made it look like stars, and he overslept the next morning. The first morning of the existence of the Beit HaMikdash, of that temple that he had longed to build. The idea is that fundamentally there's no such thing as perfection. It's not a perfect world. We're not perfect people. And the highs are immediately followed by the lows. From the beginning and all the way through. But more than that, more than the religious brokenness, there is the physical brokenness. You have a verse in Devarim in Deuteronomy, Kilo Yechdal Ha'evyon Mikarev Ha'aretz. Means, the pauper will never cease from the land. There will always be poverty. There will always be suffering. The Talmud has numerous discussions of a question of what's called in Hebrew, Tzadik Vera Lo. Right? What does Tzadik Vera Lo mean? There are righteous people who suffer, right? Theodicy, when bad things happen to good people. Discussed over and over in the Talmud with different answers each time. People shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that there's one monolithic explanation. There ain't. There are multiple explanations that are offered because it's a phenomenon they are familiar with. I brought you source number 17, a classic idea found in Kabbalah. In Hebrew it's called Shvirat HaKelim. The second verse in the Torah says, V'haaretz haita tohu vavohu. The land was tohu and bohu. And no one knows what tohu and bohu mean. There are all sorts of suggestions. Emptiness, void, all sorts of fun explanations. But no one really... Sorry?
Chaos.
Chaos, right? I've seen chaos as a translation. So take a look at what the Chida, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai wrote, quoting the students of the Ari. He says in number 17, this is the secret of the breaking of the vessels. Shvirat HaKelim. The concept of the breaking of the vessels, this Kabbalistic idea, is that God pours light into the universe to create it, but as a physical world, it's not able to tolerate that level of purity, and the vessel God has created to hold that light shatters. And that the job of humanity is to collect those sparks of light that have scattered from that original breaking. But fundamentally, what is the idea of Shvirat HaKelim if not a recognition that the world is a broken place? This is simply the truth. In source number 18, I brought you one last source on this point. Rabbi Shalom Carmi quoted Rabbi Cook, Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook. I'm going to explain it outside of the text, just because the text is a little hefty, but you can see it there. In Judaism, we have a concept of Yibum, right? The law of Yibum says that in the event that, God forbid, a man and a woman are married and they don't have children, and then the husband dies, the woman can marry her brother-in-law, right, her husband's brother. If they don't want to, then they do chalitza. They separate from each other. If they do want to, they get married. They have children, and then the children assume the estate of the deceased former husband. So Rabbi Cook noted the Talmud's section that deals with the laws of marriage, right, Seder Nashim, starts with this section of law of Yibum. It doesn't start with how you get engaged. It doesn't start with what a chuppah looks like. It doesn't start with laws of married life. It doesn't even start with divorce. It starts with this case, which, you know, we would hope would not be the norm, in which there are no children, and then the husband dies. Why in the world do you start with that as your opening concept? To which the answer is, and that's what Rabbi Carmi notes from Rabbi Cook in source number 18. Because the recognition is that Torah has to apply not only under ideal circumstances, the perfect world, the young couple as they walk down the aisle to the chuppah, and everybody is happy and rejoicing. You have to recognize that there's also brokenness in our world, and that Judaism has to address it, and it does so at the outset. To my mind, people who suffer from depression are simply perceptive. They're just perceptive. They see the brokenness of the world around them. And the problem that they have is dealing with the intensity of that perception. I saw any number of articles, I thought about bringing it on the source sheet but decided against, but you've probably seen it too, about how highly intelligent people are more apt to suffer from depression than others. Take a look at what I brought you instead of those articles was just a one-liner from Ernest Hemingway, who certainly knew of such things. In number 19, happiness in intelligent people is the rarest thing I know. The reality is that they're just people who are dealing with depression have difficulty with the intensity of that perception. Now, again, I go back to what I said in the beginning. There's the biochemical piece of this as well, which you can't dismiss. But I think it's important to recognize, even for people who aren't dealing with the biochemical aspect of it, who are just dealing with the psychological aspect of it, it's simply that. They see what Judaism recognizes, which is the challenge of living in a world that has all of these flaws. So that's the first point that I think is important that emerges from an understanding of Jewish teachings. Second, Judaism emphasizes a practical approach to a sense of sadness and grief. And again, this isn't going to help someone who's dealing with a biochemical situation. I go back to Rabbi Dr. Twersky's comment about trying to tune the television when it's not plugged in. Nonetheless, the approach within Judaism is that you don't look for why did this happen to me and dwell on the sadness. The question is, so what do I do now? What's my response to sadness supposed to be? If you take a look at source number 20, Rabbi Yosef Do Soloveitchik, in an article called Kol Dodi Do Fake, this is the translation from Professor Kaplan, we ask neither about the cause of evil nor about its purpose, but rather about how it might be mended and elevated. What do I do? I'll come back. I'm looking at my time and just trying to gauge what I can do. But that's a very important principle, I think. And if you take a look at source number 21, if you want it from a Hasidish perspective, Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin wrote about Yehush, about abandonment of hope, and he said, a Jew must never abandon hope in any arena, whether in physical issues, as in the Talmud statement, even if a sharp sword is on one's neck, he should not refrain from seeking divine mercy. Or in spiritual issues, even when he has sunk to the place where he has sunk. The entire structure of the nation of Israel came after complete abandonment of hope, for Abram and Sarah were old. He says, we've come from that. That's, and he goes on. I didn't bring you his whole piece. I felt like I had enough sources on here. The truth of the matter is that Jewish history is filled with moments when somebody could have abandoned hope and said, it's all over. He says, you can't do that. Instead, you ask, why am I here? What am I meant to accomplish? What am I meant to achieve here? I had a friend. He was the Chabad rabbi in Allentown when I lived there. He used to say that if he takes a wrong turn while driving, right? This is before all the different phone apps and everything else, okay? There used to be a concept called wrong turns. When I take a wrong turn while I'm driving and I miss my exit and I'm now way away from where I need to be, so the question I ask myself is, what am I supposed to accomplish here? Who am I supposed to meet? Who am I supposed to have a conversation with? And I think it's a very healthy way to deal with these sorts of things if one is able to get into that frame of mind. And so that's a second element, is dealing practically with a sense of sadness. Third, the need for a sense of purpose. We're going to talk about this more in week 6, because that's really at the heart of logotherapy when we get to that. But fundamentally, a person needs to have a sense of where they came from and where they're going. And I bring you a quote here in source number 22 from the second Gera Rebbe, the Sfas Emes, Rabbi Yehuda Leib Alter. He said, one must always remember one's origin. And remembering this will bring strength and energy in all of one's actions. One who forgets the beginning falls into depression. If you think back to the weekly Torah portion from last Shabbos, the story of Rivka, right? This is a longer dvarta, a longer thought that I'm just scrunched down a little bit. But Rivka is pregnant, right? After 20 years of praying for a child, she's finally pregnant, and there's this churning going on inside of her, and she doesn't know what's wrong, but she's afraid that something is indeed wrong, and she says, "In kein lama ze anochi." If this is what I am dealing with, lama ze anochi, why me? Which is a very hard phrase to translate. We actually had a class on this a couple of years ago when we did the series on the matriarchs. So this was one of the weeks. So she says, lama ze anochi, which could be translated as why me, why is this to me? And the response that she gets, she seeks counsel from God, and the response she gets is, there are two nations in your belly, two nations will spread forth from your womb, and one will triumph over the other, the greater will serve the younger. And you look at that story and ask yourself, did she walk away feeling, okay, I feel better now? Your question was, if I have to deal with this, why me? And your answer is, yeah, you've got twins, and they're going to fight a lot, and you ain't seen nothing yet, because when they come out, they're going to fight some more. Oh, okay. How about, reading like What to Expect? What was the message here? So I saw a beautiful, beautiful idea, which to me explained everything. Rivka, when the light comes in, Rivka starts out as the chosen one. Right? That's how she begins. Eliezer comes to her house. The servant of Abraham comes to her house and says, this is all from God. Because I had a conversation with God right before at the well, and you did everything that God said you would do, and you're from the right family. It's all preordained. God wants you to be the matriarch of the Jewish people. And then she comes to the house, and it's 20 years, and she's no matriarch. Right? She doesn't know what's going on. And then she is pregnant, and she's suffering in the pregnancy, and she says, why me? Why did you pick me? What is it about me that's eligible? I'm doing a bad job with the pregnancy. I did a bad job beforehand. What makes you think that maybe it should be somebody else? To which the response comes, Shnei goyim bevitneich. There are two nations in your womb. You're the one who matters. Shnei le'umim mimei ayechi paredu. Two nations are going to spread out starting from you. In other words, it's a reinforcement of the selection from 20 years before. It's a statement of, no, this wasn't the mistake. It really is you. And yes, there are going to be issues for these kids, and they need you. And of course, that's the way it plays out. Right? Because the kids are born, and we have the problem of Esav the bad guy, Yaakov the good guy, the blessing's going to go to Esav, Yitzchak doesn't know, right? And she has to be the one to make everything work. She has to be the one to make sure the blessing goes to Yaakov, and then she has to be the one who's going to send Yaakov out of town so that Esav doesn't kill him. Right? It's all on her shoulders. Without her, the Jewish people die then. It's all a function of who she is and what she brings to the table. Skills that she probably develops as a kid, growing up in the house of Lavan, her very interesting brother. There's a lot to be said about this. But fundamentally, it is all about her, which is why Yaakov says to his mother, when his mother says to him, go trick your father, he says, I'm really not sure this is a good idea. Right? He's going to be angry. And she says, Alai kilalascha b'ni, the curse is going to be on me. Which sounds like a lot of hubris, the curse is on me. But no, this is my call. God wanted me to be the one in this spot. This is my mission. And that's what she tells him. My point in bringing you this digression is to say that she has a sense of purpose. God doesn't say to her, oh, don't worry, I'm going to take away the pain of your pregnancy. He doesn't say to her, things are going to get better. But he gives her a sense of purpose. He says, yeah, it's you. It has to be you. And that's what helps her to get through it. So it's a sense of purpose that I think is very important that, again, we're going to come back to when we talk about logotherapy. The last point, and probably the on a level, I said the first one was most important, but I think the fourth one also is most important, and deal with the fact that there are two things that are most important, is the importance of community in terms of looking out for each other. And I brought you two sources, 23, 24, and 25. I'm not going to read you 23 out loud. because I'm going to start crying, and I don't want to do that. You can do that yourself. You can read that yourself. It's a blog post that I read 10 years ago that has really stuck with me from a woman who was dealing with depression in her community, and the specific event, very painful event that she describes. It's really important that people look out for each other. And I bring you, instead of reading you 23 out loud, I'm going to jump to 24. Joseph is in jail in Egypt. He's with the butler and the baker, who have their frightening dreams, right? Take a look at 24. Joseph came to them in the morning, and he saw them. And the Hebrew is, v'hinam zo'afim, they were upset. And he asked the officers of Pharaoh who were with him in his master's jail, in the Hebrew, madua pnechem ra'im hayam, why are your faces down today? That moment leads to him interpreting their dreams, which is what enables him to be in position when Pharaoh has his dream to explain it for the Pharaoh, which is what enables him to save a country from famine and his own family as well, which triggers ultimately the descent of the Jews to Egypt, and then they're getting out of Egypt and coming back to their land with the Torah. Jewish history is changed by the moment when he sees the people who are upset, and he asks, why are your faces down today? It's that kind of sensitivity that we're looking for. Similarly, in source number 25, regarding the mitzvah of Maaser Sheni, which is a mitzvah of taking a tenth of your produce in certain years to Jerusalem and eating it there, and the Jew is supposed to declare before God that I did everything you commanded me. I've handled everything properly with all of my tithes. It's not only Maaser Sheni, it's the tithes in general. I have done everything you commanded me. And the Mishnah says, what does that mean? I have done everything you've commanded me. There are previous verses that talk about how I disposed of it properly. What are you adding with I have done everything you commanded me? And the answer is, I have rejoiced and I have helped others rejoice. That's what God commands us to do, is to share with others and bring them joy as well. I realize that I raced through the last 20 minutes of this, but I hope that that the point is clear. Number one, Judaism recognizes and has recognized for a long time the biological as well as psychological aspects of depression, and it's been dealt with within halacha, within Jewish law, with an understanding of its severity. Obviously, with the growth of understanding in psychology, we've had greater understanding of what its roots are. But within Judaism, there are at least these four ideas that I think are very important for dealing with the depression from a psychological perspective. Recognizing that it's not unrealistic for people to be depressed. There are real causes for depression in the world. It's built into the way Judaism views the world. Number two, dealing practically with a sense of grief. Asking, what can I do, is a very Jewish response. Number three, in general, having a sense of purpose, like Rivka gains in that story, is so important. And then number four, the importance of community in looking out for each other. I close with a piece that you can read later if you wish. It's from CNN. A transcript from a show they did. They interviewed a police officer in Japan, Yukio Shige, who was patrolling cliffs that are known as a site for suicide, and how he made it his habit over the years when he saw people there who looked like they were about to do this, to actually stop them, to interview them, to have a conversation with them, and he has saved 129 people from jumping. It's really remarkable what one can do. I'm going to stick around for a bit to talk, because I know I didn't allow for the conversations in the course of the last 20 minutes. But please come up, and I'll be glad to continue it that way. Thank you very much.